From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very grateful for that support. We wish we could sit down with each one of you and tell you how much your support means to what we're doing. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, courts in Hawaii and Maryland have blocked the latest of the administration's travel bans, at least for now. The final decision on version 3 of the ban is likely to eventually come from the Supreme Court. And the White House, having itself struck down a cornerstone of the Affordable Care Act last week, seemed to approve of a bipartisan congressional plan to reinstate cost-sharing reductions for a limited term. Since then, however, the president's position has seemed to change at least one more time, with confusing messages emanating on, of course you guessed it, on Twitter. Jesus may be widely revered as the Prince of Peace, but that isn't stopping many Republican voters who are increasingly identified with conservative Christianity on culture war issues from feeling enthusiastic about military possible nuclear action. A new Quinnipiac poll shows a shocking 46% supporting a preemptive nuclear strike on North Korea. And on the heels of the president declaring that someone should take a look at the licenses of news outlets he's unhappy with, the Attorney General of the United States told a Senate hearing that he could not make a blanket commitment not to jail journalists. This in the name of stopping leaks and ongoing obsession for this administration, although there can be no denying that again and again leaks and confidential informants have forced information into the open that has been essential for us to know. That ultimately is the role of a free press. And I guess this administration knows that all too well. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
In the space of 8 days at the end of September and the beginning of October, FFRF has won 3 significant state church lawsuits.
A profoundly disappointing court decision came this week in a challenge to a ban on atheist invocations in the House of Representatives. Leading the challenge was the Freedom From Religion Foundation, but there were notable wins as well in what turned out to be a very busy couple of weeks for the organization. In an age where the political religious right seems to have all but taken over our government, it's an important time to catch up with the foundation's co-president, Dan Barker, and we will do just that on this week's show.
A whole lot of Christians around feel like something's wrong. This is our opportunity not to complain about other people who don't get it. My hope is that we could decide we're going to get on the way of love.
Brian McLaren is a favorite author, a theologian, activist, and public speaker. His latest book has just come out in paperback. The intriguing title is The Great Spiritual Migration: How the World's Largest Religion is Seeking a Better Way to Be Christian. And I'm eager to welcome the author back to State of Belief Radio this week. But first,
you know, we're getting near that beautiful Christmas season that people don't talk about anymore. They don't use the word Christmas because it's not politically correct. You go to department stores and they'll say Happy New Year and they'll say other things. And guess what? We're saying Merry Christmas again.
It used to be tough to find mainstream coverage of the political religious right's theocratic festival of self-righteousness, the Values Voter Summit in Washington, D.C., but that was before the President of the United States wanted to speak every year, and he did that this year. Writer Peter Montgomery, senior fellow at People for the American Way, was there for all of the excitement and lived to tell about it, and so I'm very happy to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio. Peter, Merry Christmas and welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Walt. It's always great to talk to you.
Peter, what do you see as more absurd, that kind of reasoning that I've just mentioned, or what you heard at the Values Voter Summit a week ago in our nation's capital?
Well, there was certainly a lot of absurdity at the Values Voter Summit, including the idea that somehow Donald Trump is saving Christmas for us. So it's all there together. But, you know, the part of the summit was this triumphalist celebration of the fact that Christian conservatives helped put Trump in the White House, and part of it was whining that the church is shackled and needs to be liberated by doing away with the Johnson Amendment.
Oh, my goodness. Peter, would you identify who's to blame for all of this?
Well, the big organizer is the Family Research Council, which is one of the biggest and most politically active religious right groups in the country. And they started running this Values Voter Summit after the Christian Coalition, which used to have a big annual conference called The Road to Victory. Mm-hmm. And when the Christian Coalition kind of imploded, FRC picked it up, and now they run this along with some other religious right co-sponsors. This year it included the American Family Association, Gary Bauer's American Values Groups, and a few others. It's a handful of religious right groups and sponsorship from Oklahoma Wesleyan University. You know, last year they were worried about the election and geared up for the election, but there was a lot of almost desperate rhetoric about the fact that if Hillary Clinton won, it would literally be the end of religious freedom in America, and, you know, we'd see Christians being hauled off to jail. This year, obviously, is very different because they're feeling triumphant, and so they are claiming victory and trying to very aggressively move the agenda during the time that they have conservative control of the White House and both houses of Congress. They're feeling, you know, triumphant about having Trump in the White House, and the fact that Trump came last year and that he came back this year was a big deal for them. Mm-hmm. The next speaker that got the most attention here was Steve Bannon, who came on Saturday, and along with Sebastian Gorka, both formerly of the White House, they just declared all-out war on the parts of the Republican Party that they see as insufficiently bought into Trumpism and insufficiently supportive of the president. So while the religious right has spent years cultivating ties with, you know, Republican congressional leaders, mm-hmm. there was a big declaration of war at this conference, which was quite something. I noted in one of my blog posts that it was just, you know, 4 months ago at another big religious right gathering put on by Ralph Reed's Faith and Freedom Coalition that they had Mitch McConnell celebrated as kind of the religious right hero for having held open a Supreme Court seat mm-hmm. that Trump could fill with Gorsuch. And he was, you know, welcomed as this kind of savior. And yet, just 4 months later at this conference in the same hotel ballroom, he was vilified and targeted for defeat.
Did you see any evidence of discomfort with them hearing the party bashed like it was and told that people were there and were going to try to disband the party as it is now?
I think there probably was some discomfort, you know, at a luncheon after Bannon spoke. I think it was Gary Bauer defended Mitch McConnell a little bit from some of the attacks that he had gotten. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the things that happened is that the religious right leaders, they have gotten almost everything they wanted from mm-hmm. Trump. Yeah. He's worked hard to make them happy, and mm-hmm. they're deliriously happy with Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, with a brutally expanded global gag rule on U.S. foreign aid, moves to roll back progress on LGBT equality. So if they're going to pick between Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump, they're going to go with Donald Trump because he's given them what they want.
Peter, what stood out most in your mind, or what story would you want to tell that you prefaced by saying, you won't believe this.
Well, I'll give you a funny one and a serious one.
Okay.
The funny one was on a Friday morning breakfast at which one of the speakers was a George W. Bush impersonator. But part of his presentation was to pick up a guitar and sing a version of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah that he had written lyrics turning it into a praise song for Donald Trump, with all the people then in the audience, you know, singing along on Hallelujah in the chorus. And that was a mind-blowing way to start the day on Friday morning. And more seriously, one of the other big heroes of this conference was Roy Moore, who recently became the Republican nominee for Senate from Alabama. You know, this is someone whose extremism on church-state issues and on, there's nobody else like him. He's twice gotten kicked out of his job as the Chief Justice of the state of Alabama for defying federal court orders that he thought violated his religious beliefs. And he was honored at a luncheon by the American Family Association where he spoke, and then he was also given a prime speaking spot on the main podium. And to me, the embrace of Roy Moore by not only the religious right, but by Republican Party officials, you know, we ought to be able to go say Republicans, anybody who's embracing Roy Moore has to stop calling themselves an advocate for the Constitution or the rule of law, because Roy Moore is just in defiance of both of those. But it was very telling that in the introduction of Roy Moore at the American Family Association in luncheon, the person from the AFA that introduced him said that Moore is the tip of the spear in what we need to usher America back to its place in submission to our holy God. So that tells you a lot about where the movement is and where they want to go.
Beyond all that kind of theocratic rhetoric, were there any racial overtones that you noticed? Because I'm afraid these themes are increasingly getting intertwined in our culture.
Well, you certainly, Steve Bannon, whose rhetoric and who, you know, helped steer the Trump campaign in a way that just electrified the white nationalists and white supremacists, you know, he used rhetoric about you activists and people who helped elect Roy Moore, you know, you are going to help us save the Judeo-Christian West from the globalists. And, you know, that's exactly the kind of rhetoric that is used by the white nationalists, by the alt-right, that Bannon turned Breitbart into a platform for. So, you know, it was not overt racism, but it was certainly using the same kind of coded language that the Trump administration used that fired up and energized so many of the white nationalists.
I can't help but notice, no matter the balance of power they dominate right now, conservatives find ways to engage this language of grievance and victimization. Did you hear a lot of that?
Yes, and it's a little harder for them to engage in that when they're triumphant, but they certainly still are. You know, Steve Bannon really tried to rile people up into this war against the Republican establishment, you know, again, by talking about the economic war crimes, was the term he used, that the elites have unleashed on Main Street America and on people whose jobs were shipped overseas. There was a panel I went to on how to resist transgender inclusion in school policies, you know, that talked about the totalitarianism from the bullies of the transgender movement. So that kind of riling people up with victimization rhetoric and with Christian persecution rhetoric is still very much on tap.
Peter, I really think most Americans still don't get the agenda and the power of this increasingly influential group of Christianist conservatives. I know video of this year's Values Voter Summit's available online, but if you could highlight or give us just one other snapshot that you want everybody to hear so they will really be aware of what this is all like and what it could lead to.
Looking at Roy Moore as the kind of pinnacle of their movement in some sense, This is a person who just overtly believes that Christians have a privileged place in the United States, that people of other faiths don't, who has defied the Supreme Court and federal court orders proudly, and who makes that a centerpiece of who he is and his campaign. To me, that's just, it's so troubling, because it says that the constitutional protections that we all count on for our own religious liberty and being able to depend on the courts to uphold the rule of law. Here's someone who is very close to being elected to the U.S. Senate, who openly defies those in favor of his Christian nation agenda, mm-hmm. and that he is not being repudiated by the Republican Party. He's being embraced. And I think that's really troubling. And along with that and the federal judges that Trump is putting on the federal courts, along with Neil Gorsuch in the Supreme Court, it's a very troubling group of judges. And again, referring back to an earlier religious right gathering this year in June, there were staffers from the House and Senate and White House talking openly about what they were dreaming of. If they had Trump for 8 years and they could get 400 or 500 federal judges who look at the Constitution the way they do, they would roll back the New Deal, the Great Society. They would make a lot of what the federal government does to take care of people unconstitutional. And that's tied up with a religious right worldview out of Christian Reconstructionism, that the government doesn't have a role in taking care of poor people or educating people. That's the job of the church and the family. And so there's a very concerted movement out there to radically alter our constitutional structure in a way that I think very few people are aware of.
Peter Montgomery is a senior fellow at People for the American Way, a journalist who excels at chronicling the insidious work of the political religious right. He writes for rightwingwatch.org, the Huffington Post, and elsewhere. Peter, great thanks for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. I really appreciate the chance to be on again.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. I'll talk with Dan Barker of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And up next, author and theologian Brian McLaren. His latest book is The Great Spiritual Migration: How the World's Largest Religion is Seeking a Better Way to Be Christian. Has just been published in paperback. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. In an era of seemingly endless bad news and dark topics, this book title is disarmingly positive. The Great Spiritual Migration: How the World's Largest Religion is Seeking a Better Way to Be Christian. The author is noted theologian, teacher, activist, and public speaker, the Reverend Brian McLaren. And I'm delighted to have him back with us on State of Belief Radio. Brian, welcome back.
Welton, it's always fantastic to be with you. Glad to be here.
This book, just out in paperback, it is awfully positive sounding in what many see as a dark time. Do you agree with that?
Well, I'm glad you feel it's positive sounding, and it definitely is a dark time. And those two things can be related. As you know, very often individuals, you know, we human beings don't change, make the changes we need until things get bad enough. A person maybe isn't in shape and they don't do anything about it until they have that heart attack. And things finally get bad enough, they do something about it. And so that's why in some ways, you know, rough times in the world often are what it takes to bring people to a moment where they're ready for the change they need. And that's what I feel in this moment. I'm not optimistic in the sense that I don't think good things are inevitable in the short run, but I'm not pessimistic either, because I don't think bad things are inevitable. I feel responsible, because I think how we respond to this moment will determine an awful lot of things.
So please, Brian, describe the migration, if you would.
Sure. Well, the first thing I think it's important to remind ourselves of is that nothing stays the same. Everything changes. In fact, organizations or individuals that resist change actually change themselves because they become more resistant, more afraid, more negative, more fearful. So even the act of resisting change brings about change. And that's important in the area of religion, because a lot of people act as if their religion as it is practiced today was handed down in its full form, you know, from the sky at some point in the past, and has remained pristine and ever faithful to that original form. Everything is in movement. Everything's in motion. And so in this book, I wanted to talk about three very important movements or migrations or shifts that I see going on in the Christian community. I have to say, I have counterparts who are Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Sikh, Hindu, and other traditions who could talk about parallel migrations there. But these are migrations that I see in motion, and I consider them very hopeful. And the first is a shift in how we define what religion or spirituality or faith is. For a number of centuries in the Christian tradition, faith has been defined as a system of beliefs. And I think it's time for that to change. I think there are more and more people who are realizing that a truer and better and healthier way to define the essence of our faith is not a list or a system of beliefs. It's a way of life. And that way of life is a way of love. And that's a pretty important migration.
Do people resist that?
You know, the people who accept it too easily, I think, don't understand. Because I think more people should resist it. Because an awful lot of people have an awful lot invested in defining faith as a system of beliefs. But here's the interesting thing. I have not gotten a lot of resistance to this because I think that now more and more people are realizing, well, let's just put it in very contemporary terms. You can hold, whether you're Catholic or Protestant or whatever, you can perfectly hold to the system of beliefs that determines orthodoxy or fidelity, and you can still be a racist. You can still be a white supremacist. In other words, we're realizing that just having the right beliefs doesn't make that big a difference. And in fact, it can kind of camouflage a whole series of very, very destructive things. So we've got a lot of people who feel very proud of themselves and very satisfied in themselves because they have the right beliefs, but they're careless about the environment, or they're careless about poor people, or whatever the issue. So that's where this issue of way of life, it seems to me, for more and more people, maybe by process of elimination, they're saying, well, that didn't work, that didn't work. Maybe we really ought to focus on how we live and how we love.
What are the other two movements?
The second migration has to do with how we define God. And for a lot of people, for a lot of centuries, God has been understood as a supreme being. And that idea of supremacy is related to a kind of dictatorship or rulership of the earth by fiat or force. And the evolution of this idea of God obviously was wrapped up with nationhood and ethnicity. And so what people end up thinking is that God is the God of our people, people of our religion. It might be our race. It might be our form of government. It might be our political party. But God is for us, which means that God is against them. Now, it's very easy for Christians to see this when they hear some extremist Muslim shouting, Allahu Akbar, you know, praise be to God, when they're committing a horrible act of violence and killing. But what Christians often don't realize is we've got an awful lot of that in our history as well. And so there is a very profound theological conversation happening across monotheism in Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And this conversation is God violent or is God benevolent to all people, all creatures, all life? And if that's the case, then it's going to require us to grow up in the way we interpret the Bible, because the fact is there's a lot of passages in the Bible where God is depicted as violent. So that's the second. And then the third flows from the first two, and it's a migration from organized religion to organizing religion. In other words, religion organized for its own self-preservation and for maybe the supremacy and privilege of its own adherents. There's a migration saying, no, Religion should be organized to seek the common good, to seek the welfare of all people, beginning with the most vulnerable. So those are the three migrations.
Is it fair to say that the moment-by-moment way technology teaches us to process reality often gets in the way of observing developments that happen across much larger periods of time?
Boy, I think there's so much in that statement that deserves to be unpacked. But let me just give one example. If I can use these broad terms, conservative and progressive, conservative media love to highlight the conservative religious voices who are bold and outspoken and maybe even audacious in what they condemn and so on. Interestingly, the more progressive media also love to highlight those people because they're hoping to instill outrage in people, right? So ironically, both conservative and more progressive media end up highlighting the most conservative voices, one for praise, one for blame. But because of that focus, these subtler, but I think very real shifts that are going on in the faith community often go unnoticed. Add to that, that people whose primary understanding of Christian faith is that it's a way of life, which is a way of love, they're not going to speak out in the hateful, threatening ways that often attract media attention. They're going to express their faith in action, in kindness, in service, in working for justice. And it's very easy for that to not seem like news and not attract our attention.
Hmm. Brian, the book was published a year ago in hardcover. Now the paperback is out. In the intervening year, it seems like so much has profoundly changed. What is the role of this book in 2017 America compared to when you first wrote it?
I was finishing the book during the 2016 presidential campaign. And I think I had already turned the book in by the time that Donald Trump was the Republican front runner and leader. But it was very clear to me as I was writing the book that there was this resurgence of what I would call white Christian nationalism, which in many ways was the norm for Christianity for the last 500 years. I'm ashamed to say this. I'm brokenhearted to say this, but I think it's true. What Christians call Christianity was really white supremacist Christianity. It was a Eurocentric Christianity that had gone into the world with conquistadors and colonizers and this sense of privilege as if God had given them the manifest destiny or the right to conquer the rest of the world. And in many ways, the fruits of that have been so ugly that over the last generation or two, people have been moving away from it. But it was maybe inevitable that there would be a resurgence, either a naive or a willfully ignorant resurgence of that whole package, which is based on a system of beliefs, a view of a violent and nationalistic or tribalistic God, and religion that's organized to protect the privileges of its adherents, even at the expense of its non-adherents. That whole package, Donald Trump, he knew how to play those chords and has now gained power, and that's the group of people that have huge power in the White House and in global politics now. And there are counterparts to this in Denmark and Sweden and Austria and Australia. It's not just here. And what's, I think it's going to happen, I'm not big on prediction, but I think this is a pretty safe bet, is that if that form of Christianity continues to dominate, younger generations will leave religion at an accelerating pace because they have the moral sense to reject that.
The truth is, it looks like you are addressing a crisis that is even more crucial today than it was when you wrote the book.
I think so. I think we're seeing how much is at stake. I mean, nobody could have written this script of the last 16, 18 months. You know, if that had been a novel plot line, people would have laughed it out of existence. But here it is. And the absurdities continue to happen every day. A lot of people are freaked out. But the fact that they're freaked out says that what used to be normative is now abhorrent. And the question is, will they be paralyzed and overcome by discouragement and despair and all the rest? Will they decide to fight violence with violence, fight hate with hate, or will they seek another alternative? And that's the alternative I'm holding out in my book, and it's the alternative that I think has the potential to emerge. But I don't want to say it will unless every single one of us rises to the occasion. That's where predictions can be disempowering. I think what's far more important is to help us see the different options and then each of us to challenge ourselves to throw our energies behind the option that we think is the best.
What do you want a person who has read this book to lay it down and say, let me tell you what I learned from this book?
The action that I would like to see happen. First of all, there are a whole lot of people who've dropped out of any kind of active faith involvement. They know what they're against. They know what they're disillusioned with, but they haven't really found what they're for to throw their efforts into. And I would be really happy if a lot of those people did a little bit of detective work. And because they would be surprised that there are faith communities ready to move in a healthy direction almost everywhere, and that they would throw their energies into a faith community of that sort, who's living a way of life that's centered on nonviolent, loving understanding of God, and then wants to organize for the common good. I think there are a lot of other people who are in churches that are not that. And what I would hope that those people would do is I'd hope they make an appointment with their pastor or priest or clergy person. And I hope they say, listen, I'm sure you have a lot of very conservative people who are happy with Donald Trump, who are happy with this white Christian nationalism, who've bought that hook, line, and sinker. And I imagine they put a lot of pressure on you. They give you money and they tell you never criticize them or there'll be trouble. And I wish people would go meet with their pastor and say, I know you've got those people, but I'm on the other side. And how you respond and how we respond as a congregation affects me. And so I wish they would, in a loving, understanding way, say, listen, I can't stay in a church that walks on eggshells in these dangerous times. I can't stay in a church whose silence means complicity. Would you like me to stay and help you as a leader of this congregation, move in a more positive direction? Or is it time for me to look for another congregation? I wish people would have that kind of conversation. And then this spiritual migration may actually lead to a congregational migration, meaning they need to find a new faith community.
The Reverend Brian McLaren is a leading public theologian, a prolific writer, a fearless activist, and a compelling speaker. His invaluable books include A Generous Orthodoxy, The Secret Message of Jesus, and We Make the Road by Walking. Most recently, he's released the paperback edition of The Great Spiritual Migration, How the World's Largest Religion is Seeking a Better Way to Be Christian. Thanks so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, keep up the good work, and thanks again for having me.
For many years, essential to the work of protecting the constitutional principle of separation of church and state in this country has been the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Allied groups in this work include, of course, Interfaith Alliance. Freedom From Religion co-president Dan Barker has been on this show numerous times over the years, and I'm pleased to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio today. Dan, thanks for being with us again.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Will.
The attempts to dismantle the wall of separation seem to be coming from all directions these days. Is this the toughest environment you've ever found yourself working in?
We think so. Our 9 full-time attorneys are so busy. We get thousands of complaints every year, and they can barely get the work done. We kind of think the reason that it is tough is because the religious extremists, the religious right, has been losing and losing and losing the culture war for many decades. going all the way back to women's right to vote, to interracial marriage, to creationism in the schools, to prayer in the schools, to gay marriage, you name it. They've been losing these fights. Their numbers are getting smaller. Religious belief is shrinking all across the board, and non-belief is growing. And so they're angry. They don't like this. They don't like losing. And even though in the big picture it seems like they're snuffing out, like what happened in Europe, where most people are totally non-religious, mm-hmm. in the short run, in these few decades here, they are very dangerous, because I think they're kind of like a wounded animal that knows it's dying and it's going to take everything down it can with mm-hmm. it. They're hopeful. Some of them are optimistic, and so they're really digging in. And we non-believers are unrepresented. In Congress, for example, even though we're about a quarter of the population, the non-religious, I should say, mm-hmm. it's just a few that would say they're non-religious. And the same thing on the courts. The courts are also a relic of the older times. So there's a lot of work to do, and they can do a lot of damage in the meantime, which is actually, if meaning in life comes from working to solve problems, then we have a very meaningful next decade or two here.
Yeah. Yeah. What are, in your mind, the most dangerous challenges the separation clause is facing right now?
The money ones are always the big ones. Vouchers, school vouchers, we think are the most dangerous right now. And they're sneaking under. Our organization is here in Wisconsin, and of course, Wisconsin is one of these proving grounds for school vouchers. And it turns out that school vouchers are failing miserably, but the religious right doesn't admit it. In the Milwaukee schools, for example, you know, their results are bad. The schools are springing up and falling apart. There's some scandals involved with that. And anytime you get your hands on public money, then you can see what happens, especially with some of these Catholic dioceses that are shrinking. They're having to consolidate. And the Catholic dioceses in Milwaukee realize that their schools are a source of revenue. And especially if their schools can get public money, give out your money, then that's keeping their churches open and operating. But also there's the, the so-called Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the so-called attempt to expand. They say restore religious freedom, but there's nothing to restore. They want to expand religious freedom beyond the basic, First Amendment freedoms, so that they now have the freedom to harm others with their beliefs and discriminate. And we think that's also a dangerous move in the last couple decades.
Dan, you've had four significant court wins in less than a month, and I want to talk about those. But first, let's quickly go over this very disappointing ruling on opening prayers in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, so we've had five federal rulings in the last couple of weeks, and this one was one that was bad. The other four were great. Mm-hmm. And it's me. I'm the plaintiff in it. My representative, Mark Pocan, asked the chaplain of the House of Representatives to allow me, as he allows others, mm-hmm. to come in and be a guest chaplain for the day to open a session of Congress with a secular invocation. Mm-hmm. His only duty is to lead a prayer before Congress. The chaplain put up all sorts of roadblocks that he never puts up to anybody else. In fact, he's had many unordained people come in, gospel singers and so on, at the request of members of the House. So Mark Pocan's request to have me was denied by the chaplain, even though I am ordained. I was an ordained Christian minister, and I've been using my ordination to perform weddings. Mm-hmm. He said, no, you can't do it because you have to address a higher power. And really, we know from the court and from history that the real purpose of an opening prayer, whatever you call it, prayer invocation, mm-hmm. the purpose of it is to solemnize the occasion. Mm-hmm. And we non-believers are just as capable of solemnizing an occasion. It's our country, too. And if anything, we think the House of Representatives should be representative. The chaplain should not exclude. Well, he turned me down. So we sued in court that this was a violation of equal protection and so on. But the D.C. judge disagreed with us and said that it's okay for the chaplain to discriminate. In fact, the judge even admitted that I had standing, that I have been harmed, that I have been excluded. But it's okay because the chaplain has that prerogative to harm and exclude Americans who do want to participate in our government.
Are there next steps on this one?
Well, the next step would be to appeal. We're thinking about it, and our legal staff is considering our options. If you read the decision from the judge that just came down in the federal district there in D.C., She addressed issues that were not even raised. She thinks that we were challenging the whole idea of a guest, of a chaplaincy, which our lawsuit is not. We're not challenging the chaplaincy. We would like to participate as equal American citizens. So there are some grounds, we think, for a potential appeal of this loss.
Well, let's talk about the victories. Would you summarize the actions the foundation and our allies have prevailed in recently?
Yeah, there's four recent ones. In fact, since the beginning of this year, we've had eight really strong victories. But a couple of weeks ago, a county in Pennsylvania, Lehigh County, which has a Christian cross on its county seal and county flag, the federal court reluctantly agreed that we were right to challenge it and that that Christian cross has to be removed. And the county is appealing that loss, obviously. In Brevard County, Florida, in spite of the Greece decision, which allows anybody, including atheists, and in fact, in the Greece Supreme Court decision, it uses the word atheist. A city council or government body can allow opening prayers as long as it's open to everyone, including nonbelievers. In fact, members of ours around the country have tested this to good effect. There have been atheists and agnostics, and even some Satanists or so-called Satanists, who have opened a public meeting with prayer, and the sky didn't fall. But in Brevard County, Florida, they disallowed our members, especially our Central Florida chapter, from opening with prayer, and they're only allowing Christian ministers. And we think if they're going to allow Christian ministers and rabbis, they should allow all citizens. And so they disallowed us, and we sued, and the federal court agreed they were wrong to do that. They have to allow all points of view or don't do the practice at all. A big significant victory, which is much more national, is our housing allowance victory, which touches every clergy in the country. In the IRS code, clergy are allowed to exclude their housing from income when they file their taxes. And I used to do that when I was a minister years ago. But now that I'm working for a secular nonprofit, I don't get to do that. So Annie Laurie and I are getting a housing allowance from the Freedom from Religious Foundation, which we don't get to exclude, but ministers and priests and rabbis do get to exclude, and we think that's unfair. And we started this in 2009. It's been a long, torturous, this is our third attempt because the appeals court turned us down on standing back in 2013. But we fixed the standing. We're back in court. The IRS turned us down, and just a week or two ago, Federal Judge Barbara Crabb ruled in our favor that the housing allowance is unconstitutional. She didn't decide on a remedy yet. The remedy, we think, should be to nullify it so that no clergy are treated more favorably than the other nonprofit workers. But it could happen that the court might decide that all nonprofits will get this benefit. So we don't know what's going to happen. We do have a decision that it is unconstitutional. Governor Greg Abbott took our Bill of Rights scene out of the state capitol because he said it was mocking Christianity. And a judge just a few days ago ruled that the governor of Texas violated our free speech rights because it isn't mocking, but even if it were mocking, we have the freedom in this country, freedom of speech, to say anything we want for or against religion. So he says he's going to appeal that loss, but right now the governor of Texas has violated our free speech rights.
Are there specific cases or issues that are coming up in the near future that we need to keep an eye on?
Well, yes. In fact, we're watching the Supreme Court on the Masterpiece Cake Bakery. You know that issue about the Christian baker who wanted to deny making a cake for a gay couple. This is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which originally looked like a good idea. It was signed by Clinton, and even the ACLU and other groups were behind it. It turned out that it's been expanded to allow religious people to claim that they're being discriminated against if they're not allowed to discriminate against others. It's like they're trying to amend the Constitution and expand the First Amendment beyond just our natural freedoms, to give them the freedom to use their religion to actually actively harm others, especially when it violates the Civil Rights Act. So I think we need to be watching what's happening on this issue.
Well, thank you. Dan, if it is so blindingly clear to both of us that freedom of religion and freedom from religion are the absolute cornerstones of American liberty and democracy, why is that so impossible for many people of faith to see the damage our republic, our citizens, and our faith traditions are already suffering is almost immeasurable, and yet our work is so often portrayed as somehow being anti-religion.
Yeah, and I like that word you use, blindingly obvious. I think to the right-wing believers, Christians or Jews or Muslims, we could also use that word blinding. Dogma and ideology can also be blinding. Mm. And you're right, it's only a small minority. But most of the cases we take, or many of the cases that we take, we are joined by religious people. Mm-hmm. Most of our members are atheists and agnostics, but Roman Catholics and Protestants and Unitarians and Wiccans and Jews and others join us because they also see the importance of keeping the government neutral, mm-hmm. the importance of state-church separation.
Right.
And it actually helps our case to have plaintiffs who are believers because then it looks to the court like it's not just a bunch of angry atheists who are mad at religion.
Yeah.
We don't barge into churches. There's none of our group is going to go into your church on a Sunday morning and mm-hmm. start dragging people out of the pews. I mean, this is a free country. We can believe whatever we want.
Mm-hmm.
We don't sue individuals. We only sue the government. When the government speaks, the government can't promote or hinder religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's a lot of religious people who applaud what we're doing because it strengthens, it underscores their freedom to believe or not if the government stays out of our business.
Yeah. Well, I'm one of them and support you. And I'd like for you, before we go, to tell our listeners how they can support and get involved in the work of the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
FFRF.org. And keep your eyes open. If you see something, there's a couple dozen different areas, from religion in the schools to, you know, religious monuments to public money to so on. If you see something, you can contact us. We have a legal page where you can make a complaint. So if you see something that makes you uncomfortable, if a school teacher is forcing your kid to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance and doesn't know the law, then we can send a letter. We can inform the school district or the principal or whoever that they are, in fact, breaking the law.
Dan Barker is co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, a leading free thought legal and activist organization protecting the rights of all Americans. Dan, thanks so much for taking time to be with us again. You're doing great work, and we want to keep abreast of all of the good things you're doing.
And thank you for all your good work, too, Weldon.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We couldn't do this without you. And if you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, for goodness sakes, tell them about it. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.